Yashodanandana Vrajaganarayana Yamuna Teeravanakari Yamuna Teeravanakari Jaya Radha Madhava Kunja Vihari Jaya Radha Madhava Kunja Vihari Jaya Gopidana Vallabha Givarathari Jaya Gopidana Vallabha Givarathari Yashodanandana Vrajaganarayana Yashodanandana Vrajaganarayana Yamuna Teeravanakari Yamuna Teeravanakari Jaya Radha Madhava Kunja Vihari Jaya Radha Madhava Kunja Vihari Jai Om Vishnu Pad Paramahansa Parivraj Kacharya Stotarstha Shri Shimari Savang Desa Isi Bhakti Vedanta Swami Prabhupada Ki Jai Vantaraj Srimad Bhagavatam Ki Jai Nitai Gopremanande Hari Hari Bol Samaveta Bhakti Vrinda Ki Jai All grace to the assembled devotee. All grace to the assembled devotee. All grace to the assembled devotee. All grace to Sri Sri Guru Gauranga. Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya. Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya Srimad Bhagavatam, Canto 1, Chapter 4 Texts 26 through 33. We have 8 verses today. We're going all the way to the end of the chapter. Text 26, the word meanings, evam thus, pravrittasya, one who is engaged in. So this word, I wanted to mention something about. When you have two consonants together like this, they should be both pronounced. Somehow it's almost like a, it's kind of a bit of a subtle thing, but it's not pravrittasya, it's pravrittasya. Here, both T's, pravrittasya. Otherwise, you don't get enough syllables if you don't do that little bit of a pause there. Pravrittasya. It's like Brahmaputta prasannatma, two N's. You know, when often in Sanskrit is Devanagari, sometimes it's all run together. So you could actually put a space there in your mind. Pravrittasya. This is actually a, you know, sometimes in the Bhagavatam, we hear how some demon says some really bad thing about Krishna, then Vishnu Chakravarti Thakur says, well, actually, this is what he's really saying, and he's glorifying Krishna. And one of the reasons you can do that is because of the way the Sanskrit is written sometimes, it's all just run together, so you can split it where you want to. Now, Satyaraj actually wrote an article recently, BTG, or for BTG, it hasn't been printed yet. But he says this also happens in the Bible, in the Hebrew translation. And he gave an example. Of course, there was some scholar was giving an example of how you can translate things in different ways. And he used a sentence, God is N-O-W-H-E-R-E. So you can read that either as God is now here or God is nowhere. So if you're an atheist, you take it one way, and if you're a theist, you take it a different way. Anyway, so here you have to say pravrittasya, a little bit of sort of a pause in the middle of the word. So pravrittasya means one who is engaged in. The core of this is vritti. Vritti means occupation, engagement. Pravrittasya, one who is engaged in. Sada, always. Bhutanam, of the living beings. Shreyasi, in the ultimate good. Dvijaha, O twice born. Sarvat lakena api. By all means, yada, when, na, not, atushat, become satisfied. Hridayam, mind, tataha, at that time. Evam pravrittasya sada. Bhutanam shreyasi dvija. Sarvatma kena api yada. Natushyat hridhayam tata. Evam pravrittasya sada. Bhutanam shreyasi dvija. Sarvatma kenapi yada. Natushya dridhayam yathata. Evam pravrittasya sada. Bhutanam shreyasi dvija. Sarvatma kenapi yada. Natushya dridhayam tata. Translation. O twice-born Brahmanas, still his mind was not satisfied, although he engaged himself in working for the total welfare of all people. Purport. Sri Vyasadeva was not satisfied with himself, although he had prepared literatures of Vedic value for the all-around welfare of the general mass of people. It was expected that he would be satisfied by all such activities, but ultimately he was not satisfied. Om Jnana Timirantasya Jnananjana Shalakaya Chakshurun Militam Yena Tasmai Sri Gurave Namaha Srila Prabhupada Ki Jai. Let's start with a little context here. You're on the fourth chapter of the first canto. We've been introduced to Suta Goswami and the sages of Naimisharanya. Suta Goswami has, in the third chapter, answered one of the questions. The sages asked six questions, so he addressed one of them in the third chapter. Because one of the questions was, please tell us about the avatars of the Lord. So the whole third chapter is a list of incarnations of Krishna. And it also, of course, establishes Krishna Stu Bhagavan Swayam. Krishna is in a special category. He's Swayam Bhagavan. He's God himself, the original. So then at the beginning of this chapter, Shaunaka Rishi, he's the spokesperson for the sages. So he asks, please relate the pious message of Srimad Bhagavatam, which was spoken by the great and powerful Shukadeva Goswami. In what period and at what place was this first begun, and why was this taken up? From where did Krishna Dwaipayana Vyas, the great sage, get the inspiration to compile this literature? So they're asking about the history of the Srimad Bhagavatam. How did it get spoken? I believe Shukadeva Goswami has mentioned that he used the word Bhagavatam. He will speak the Bhagavatam. So Shaunaka Rishi is asking for more information about that. So in the verses that we just read, what we read about throughout this chapter, of course we're at the end of the chapter now, also included in Shaunaka Rishi's question was he asked about Shukadeva Goswami and Maharaj Pariksit. Because he knew that Vyasadeva, that the Bhagavatam is centered around their conversation, that even though Vyasadeva wrote it, they're primary characters in this great book. So we heard something about the questions about Pariksit Maharaj. Let's see where Suta Goswami. So he begins. Suta Goswami begins his reply by mentioning that Vyasadeva was born. Then he says, Once upon a time, Vyasadeva, as the sun rose, took his morning ablutions in the waters of the Saraswati and sat alone to concentrate. The great sage saw the anomalies and the duties of the millennium. This happens on the earth in different ages due to unseen forces in the course of time. So then we hear about what Vyasadeva is thinking about. One important verse in this, a word in this verse that we had today is Shreyasi. His motive was to help people. Shreyas, of course, I think everyone is familiar with that word, these two ideas, Shreya and Preya. So Preya means immediate gratification, and Shreyas means ultimate benefit, something that's ultimately beneficial. So here it said that this is what this Vyasadeva's motive was. He saw that things are going to get really bad because he's a great seer. By the way, Vyasadeva is mentioned by Jiva Goswami in the Tattva Sandarbha that there's a Vyasadeva in every Dwapara Yuga. And he does this same thing, Veda Vyas, which means that he organizes the Vedas. This is one of the things that we've heard about in previous verses in this chapter. It talks about what Vyasadeva decided to do. He wanted to help everyone. So one, he thought, well, people are helped by the Vedas, but the Vedas are so vast and they're, you might say, they're somewhat disorganized. So let me organize them and make it easier for people, because people's brains are going downhill as time progresses. So let me make it, you know, organize it in such a way that it's in pieces that they can draw from more easily. In fact, part of that disaligns actually, you know, in Vedic sacrifice, there are four priests. So these four priests have different responsibilities and they have to be expert in different areas. So it also made it easier for them. What they had to do in the past was sort of search the whole gamut of the Vedic literature and find, oh, this is a mantra that I'm supposed to chant at this time and so on. And mantras are kind of hidden here and there. So he separated them out. There's an analogy given in the 12th canto that it's like a king who has four kinds of valuable jewels and they're all just, you know, they've been in one bag together. So he pours them on the table and he separates them out. The diamonds go here, the emeralds go here, the rubies go here, so on, four different piles. So Vyasadeva took the gems that were all mixed together in the Vedas and he organized them. And then his disciples, he gave them authority to take care of them and pass them on to their disciples. These four Vedas, and also the fifth Veda. The fifth Veda is the Itihasas and Puranas. The Itihasas means the Mahabharata and the Ramayana, and of course the Puranas. We know there are 18 primary Puranas. So those were given to the charge of Romaharshan, actually. We know the story in the Bhagavatam, how Romaharshan was speaking to sages and he offended Lord Balaram, and Lord Balaram killed him with a piece of straw. And then Ugrasrava, his son, Sutta Goswami, he took over the recitation of the Puranas. So the Vyasadeva's motive was, so he was seeing, the point I was going to mention about Vyasadeva, so there's a Vyasadeva that does this, a similar kind of thing, organizes the Vedas in every Dwapara Yuga. And it said in the, I'm trying to remember, but I'm not quite sure, but I think Jiva Goswami actually quotes a verse. Usually everything he says, he quotes a Vedic verse. He doesn't just say. He quotes either from the Upanishads or from the Puranas, and primarily from the Srimad Bhagavatam, although this is not mentioned in the Bhagavatam. So, but some authorized Shastra mentions that in this particular Dwapara Yuga that we just had, Vyasadeva was Vishnu Tattva. He's not always Vishnu Tattva. Generally, he's Shaktyavesh Avatar. He's empowered by Krishna. But in the previous Vyasadeva that we're familiar with, he was actually a Vishnu Tattva. So he did this work. So we're hearing about him. Of course, we heard Kalakanta the other day was mentioning how he spoke the three introductory verses of the Srimad Bhagavatam. He's the one who's writing all of this, even though Pariksit Maharaj and Shukadeva Goswami are the main characters and Shukadeva is the main speaker. There are many speakers, but the person who composed it, there's a question about whether he actually wrote it with a pen and paper, but he composed it and put it together. So that's Vyasadeva. And Kalakanta was mentioning how he himself, this is something I've often thought about too, is that he refers to himself as Mahamuni. So Mahamuni means a great sage. So you think, well, that doesn't sound very humble, referring to yourself as Mahamuni. So of course, he's completely humble. There's no question about it. He doesn't have any faults like we would have, a pride. So he can do that. But there's another explanation for this, which I'm pretty sure this also comes up in Tattvasandarbha, is that Mahamuni also means Krishna. That Mahamuni Krite means Krishna wrote this. Krishna wrote the Bhagavatam. Of course, in a kind of literal sense, of course, Krishna inspires anyone who writes Shastra. They're inspired by God. So in that sense, they wrote it. Just like Prabhupada said, I have not written these books. Krishna has written them. So he's saying that the inspiration is coming from Krishna. But of course, in the literal sense, as I was just mentioning, also, Vyasadeva is an incarnation of Krishna, direct incarnation. So Mahamuni, in that sense, I mean, God wrote it. And by the way, I'm God, but we won't talk about that right now. So Vyasadeva, he's Shreyasi. He's interested in helping others. So he's sitting down to meditate. What can I do? Things are going to get really bad. He could foresee that things were going downhill. Just as we can see, actually, today, it's pretty easy to see. Things have been going downhill for some time, and they seem to be getting worse. When I think of the immorality in society, it's just astounding. What is considered normal today and okay, just like something that's unthinkable, like abortion, is just... And now they have the debate whether partial birth abortion is okay, or actually if the child is born... This is something going on right now in Congress. far as I know, some bill has been proposed. The idea is that, you know, if a child is born alive, there should be a law that the child has to be taken care of. Because sometimes abortion, the child is born alive. But what they, well, then they do, they kill it. They kill him or her. They kill the child. And people think that's okay. They actually think that's okay. Killing a child in the womb, that's okay. So how far things have gone downhill, killing your own child in the womb is just unthinkable. So we can also see, oh boy, things are going downhill, and they're going, it's hard to imagine how far they will go, but we know they'll go, it'll get worse and worse. So Vyasadeva is seeing that, he's thinking, I have to do something. Of course, he's a great soul, great sage. And these great personalities, they're motivated by helping others. This is their, you can say really, their primary characteristic. You know, sometimes it's said that Krishna's greatest quality is that he responds to his devotees. Basically, he's controlled by his devotees, actually. Bhakta Vasyata. He's controlled by his devotees. So he's so powerful, he creates everything out of the pores of his body, millions and millions of universes. But when Mother Yashoda wants to tie him up, he can't resist. I have to respond to this. So that's a great quality. So the great quality of these sages, their mercy, they feel this in their hearts, this burning desire to help humanity, to help people, stop people's suffering. So Vyasadeva, this is his motive when he's thinking this way, and he's seeing how bad things are going to be. I have to do something about this. So let's move on to the next verse. This is text number 27. I'll bring the Sanskrit up. We'll chant this one too. Nati prasida dridhaya sarvasvatya sate sucha vitarkayam vivikthasta idam chovacha dharmavit. Thus the sage, being dissatisfied at heart, at once began to reflect, because he knew the essence of religion, and he said within himself, colon, the purport, the sage began to search out the cause of not being satisfied at heart. Perfection is never attained until one is satisfied at heart. This satisfaction of heart has to be reached out beyond matter. This satisfaction of heart has to be searched out, has to be searched out beyond matter. So much import here. The perfection is never attained until one is satisfied at heart. This is definitely one of the characteristics of modern civilization, isn't it? We're trying to get satisfaction or perfection in so many ways. Perfecting technology. We think we're going to be perfectly happy if we perfect technology. But there's no satisfaction at heart. People are miserable. Suicides, I've read recently, suicides are going up more and more, especially among young people. They feel no hope for the future. They're very unhappy and dissatisfied. So even though we have everything, people cry, they want more. But we're living like kings. The poorest person in America is living like a king in former times. Still, we're not satisfied. So why? Because as it says here, the satisfaction has to be searched out beyond matter. If you keep looking here, you're never going to be satisfied. So let's go on to the next verses. Two verses, 28 and 29. Dritta-vrakti-na himaya sundansi guravognaya manita nirvyalikena krihitam chanushasanam bhavata-vyapadeshena Yamnayata Sukhasita Trishyate Yatra Dharmadi Sri Shudradi Virapyuta. So now Vyasadeva is going to mention some of the things that he's done because he wants to help people. So he's going to go through some of the things that he has done in pursuit of that goal of his. I have, under strict disciplinary vows, unpretentiously worshipped the Vedas. The word for that is nirvyalikena. Nirvyalika means unpretentious. I have under strict disciplinary vows unpretentiously worshipped the Vedas, the spiritual master, and the altar of sacrifice. I have also abided by the rulings and have shown the import of the disciplic succession through the explanation of the Mahabharata, by which even women, Shudras, and others, friends of the twice-born, can see the path of religion. Purport. No one can understand the import of the Vedas without having undergone a strict disciplinary vow and disciplic succession. The word is dritta vratena. Dritta vrata. Vrata is vow, dritta is firm, determined. So determined. So that means he wasn't slack in his duties in Krishna consciousness. He was very strict. And this, in the disciplic succession, he followed in the disciplic succession, didn't speculate, invent his own way. The Vedas, spiritual masters, and sacrificial fire must be worshipped by the desiring candidate. This, of course, is the traditional way. We're not centered on sacrificial fires, but this was the practice formerly. There was always a sacrificial fire. Sacrificial fire represents the Lord, and you make offerings into the sacrificial fire. Just like we have deities in our house and we want to eat, we offer to our deity. So formerly, there always had to be a sacrificial fire burning in the home. And of course, at other bigger sacrifices as well. So these things are central to the saintly person, the religious person's life. The Vedic scriptures, the scripture guides one's life, the guru guides one's life, and one worships Krishna regularly, daily. All these intricacies of Vedic knowledge are systematically presented in the Mahabharata for the understanding of the woman class, the laborer class, and the unqualified members of Brahmana, Kshatriya, and Vaishya families. In this age, the Mahabharata is more essential than the original Vedas. In Tavasundarbha, you know, Jiva Goswami explains why the Bhagavatam is the scripture that we use as our evidence for getting ultimate spiritual truth. It's our guidance. So before he gets there, he talks about the Vedas, and he says that the Mahabharata is better than the Vedas. It's more important than the Vedas. Vyasadeva also wrote the Mahabharata. The Mahabharata is a huge book. It's some millions of verses in the higher planets. And on Earth, Gopi Pranadan Prabhu says the shortest version of the Mahabharata is about 75,000 verses. And he quotes the verse, he doesn't say what the source is, but he gets, now Prabhupada would often translate it as Greater India, because Bharata, he would say, is India. Of course, Bharatvarsha, it's still called that, by some of the inhabitants at least. But there's another way to translate this also, as many words are. Maha means great, Mahatva, greatness, and Bhara means weight, so it means heavy. So it's great in the sense it's very long, it's a big book, and it's heavy because it's heavy with knowledge. It's heavy with truth. So what Prabhupada says here in the verse says that the Mahabharata, it actually contains the essential truths of the Vedas. But you have to sort of, it's a little hard to find them because there's so many verses and so many stories. And there, of course, there are places in the Bhagavatam, one or two places where it's mentioned how the Mahabharata, the essential part of it, of course, is the Bhagavad Gita. That's there. 18 chapters of the Bhagavad Gita are there. And if you read the whole book, then you're going to come across this too, which is, of course, the essence of the Vedas, Krishna's speaking. It's called Gita Upanishad. The Gita is an Upanishad. It contains essential knowledge for everything, for human life, and ultimately for going back to Godhead. So it's a very substantial book. So Vyasadeva says, I wrote the Mahabharata. I was trying to do everything I could think of to help people. I even wrote this huge book with all these stories, and I slipped in this philosophy so people could get that. You know, basically you're getting the Upanishads, because the Upanishads are the Vedas. All the Vedas are they have different parts to them. So the philosophical parts of the Vedas are the Upanishads. And the Upanishads are called Vedanta, because what it means is that they're the end or the purpose of the Vedas is the philosophy that's taught in the Upanishads. Now, of course, the Upanishads, they have a lot of... they focus a lot on the oneness, that we're one with God. Because we are, of course. We're made of the same stuff, you can say, as God. We're spirit and He's spirit. So that oneness is off, and the oneness of everything, ultimately everything is one. But we know there's a duality there, and that's also pointed out. So in the Vedanta Sutras, Vyasadeva, which Vyasadeva also wrote, he wrote the Vedanta or the Upanishads, and he also commented on them in the Vedanta Sutras. That's what Vedanta Sutra means. It's sutras, verses commenting on the Upanishad, the Vedanta. So he resolves a lot of, or at least he gives his purport to some different controversies that come up in relation among the scholars of the Vedanta, and especially showing that verses that are taken impersonally are actually about Bhagavan, the Supreme Personality of Godhead. So there, wait, I'll say this point is something I'm thinking about. I think it comes up in another upcoming verse, so I'll mention it. So let's do the next verse. Let's see. What is that? Text 30. Tatapi batamedahyo yatma chayvatmana vibhu asampanna ivabhati brahma varchasya sattama. I am feeling incomplete, though I myself am fully equipped with everything required by the Vedas. Brahma varchasya of the Vedantas. Purport. Undoubtedly, Srila Vyasadeva was complete in all the details of Vedic achievements. Purification of the living being submerged in matter is made possible by the prescribed activities of the Vedas. But the ultimate achievement is different. This is an interesting sentence. Purification of the living being submerged in matter is made possible by the prescribed activities of the Vedas. So you think, well, that's it. The Vedas purify. But Prabhupada says, but the ultimate achievement is different. So there's more than just being purified. Unless it is attained, the living being, even though fully equipped, cannot be situated in a transcendental normal stage. Srila Vyasadeva appeared to have lost the clue and therefore felt dissatisfaction. So the idea here is a point that Prabhupada would always make. You can reach Brahman, in other words, purified. You can be perfect, a siddha, as the Bhagavad Gita says. There are siddhas. But you have to go beyond being a siddha, beyond being rid of the gunas that are controlling us now. What do you do then? In other words, you're free of your disease, then you have to resume your normal activities again. So that's the idea that's being presented here. You have to be, not only do you go above the modes of material nature, but then you have to do something. Then what do you do, of course? Devotional service. You have to serve God. You have to serve Krishna. So Vyasadeva is thinking, there must be something that I'm missing. I've given all these things to purify people, but maybe there's something missing here. So let's go to text 31.
Kimba bhagavata dharma na prayena nirupita priya paramahansanam ta eva hyatuta priya.
This may be because I did not specifically point out the devotional service of the Lord, which is dear both to perfect beings and to the infallible Lord. Purport. The dissatisfaction which was being felt by Srila Vyasadeva is expressed herein in his own words. This was felt for the normal condition of the living being in the devotional service of the Lord. Unless one is fixed in the normal condition of service, neither the Lord nor the living being can become fully satisfied. That's another interesting statement, isn't it? Neither the Lord nor the living being. This defect was felt by him when Narada Muni, his spiritual master, reached him. It is described as follows. So I was thinking of this idea. Unless one is fixed in a normal condition of service, neither the Lord nor the living being can be fully satisfied. So, of course, Krishna is always satisfied. He's Atmarama. But in a certain way, it seems to be what Prabhupada is suggesting here, is that we won't be satisfied if we're not serving Krishna. And at least in relationship to us, individually, Krishna is, you might say, in a sense, not satisfied. Because he wants that relationship. We exist to be in a relationship with Krishna. And we like to have relationships. We have a few relationships. Actually, depending on how together we are, you might say, or how sociable we are, we may have more or lots of friends. Some people have lots of friends and lots of relationships. But Krishna's God. He has unlimited relationships. So if one of those relationships is not quite right, then you can say that he's uncomfortable with that, in a sense. Of course, Krishna is perfect. He doesn't have the same kinds of thoughts and moods and so on that we do. Well, he does, but in a perfect way. That seems to be the idea that Prabhupada is... Because he often talks about satisfying Krishna, as if Krishna needs us to be satisfied. Well, in a sense, you can say that he does. Or at least he wants us. He wants us to be in a pure, loving relationship with him. So, oh, I was going to read. Now, this sort of foreshadows. You know, Narada Muni will appear on the scene very soon, and he's going to tell Vyasadeva why he's unhappy. So what does he tell him? This is text 8 of the next chapter. You have not actually broadcast the sublime and spotless glories of the personality of Godhead. That philosophy which does not satisfy the transcendental senses of the Lord is considered worthless. So it's basically, Vyasadeva has already figured it out, you can say, and his spiritual master comes and confirms it. But the word here for philosophy is darshanam. So darshan. You know, in Indian philosophy, they call the six darshans, the shed darshans, the six philosophies. So the word here is philosophy. Now, actually Prabhupada mentions it. This seems to come from Vishwanath Chakravarti Thakur's commentary on this verse. That Vyasadeva has already written philosophy. He has written the Vedanta Sutras, the Vedanta Darshan. So even though he's done that, he's given philosophy, you can say, still he's not satisfied. He's given all the rituals. In other words, he's given karma kanda, and he's given jnana kanda. He's given the philosophy, he's given the rituals, the sacrifices, and he's given the philosophy behind it, and the Vedanta Sutras, but still he's not satisfied. That's the implication here. By the way, it said, you know, Krishna says in Bhagavad Gita 15:15, Vedanta Krit Veda Vedeva Chaha, that I am the compiler of the Vedanta and the knower of the Vedas. So he uses two different words, compiler and knower. The idea with knower is, I didn't write them. They're eternal. The Vedanta I wrote, Vedanta Krit, I composed the Vedanta, Vedanta Sutras, but I didn't compose the Vedas. I know the Vedas. Krishna says, I know the Vedas. But even Vyasadeva also, he knows the great sages. They know them, but they don't write them. They don't create them. They exist eternally. It's eternal knowledge. Just as Krishna exists eternally, we exist eternally. So the truth, which is what the Vedas are, the truth, knowledge, that also exists eternally. It's co-eternal with God. So it's not that Vyasadeva or Krishna wrote the Vedas. They exist eternally with him. So what, we have two more verses here. We'll get through these. It's getting late. Text 32. My glasses here. Tasyaivam kilamatmanam manyamanasya kidyata krishnasya narado bhyagad ashramam pragudaritam. As mentioned before, Narada reached the cottage of Krishna Dwaipaina Vyas on the banks of the Saraswati just as Vyasadeva was regretting his defects. What is the regretting kidyata? Defect, the word here, I think, is probably translated as inferior, or kilam, K-H-I-L-A-M, kilam, defect. Purport. The vacuum felt by Vyasadeva was not due to his lack of knowledge. Bhagavad Dharma is purely devotional service of the Lord to which the monist has no access. The monist is not counted amongst the Paramahansas, the most perfect of the renounced order of life. Srimad Bhagavatam is full of narrations of the transcendental activities of the personality of Godhead. Although Vyasadeva was an empowered divinity, he still felt dissatisfaction because in none of his words were the transcendental activities of the Lord properly explained? So he did, of course, he does talk about Krishna in different places, but not elaborately enough, apparently. The inspiration was infused by Sri Krishna directly in the heart of Vyasadeva, and thus he felt the vacuum as explained above. So Krishna is making him feel dissatisfied. It is definitely expressed here with that without the transcendental loving service of the Lord, everything is void. But in the transcendental service of the Lord, everything is tangible without any separate attempt at fruitive work or empiric philosophical speculation. So these are the two, jnana and karma. So let's go on to text 33. Tamabhigyaya sahasa pratyuttaya gatam muni pujayama sadhivam naradam sura pujitam. At the auspicious arrival of Sri Narada, Sri Vyasadeva got up respectfully and worshipped him, giving him veneration equal to that given to Brahmaji, the creator. Purport. Vidhi means Brahma, the first created living being. He is the original student as well as the professor of the Vedas. That's why he has a beard. He learned it from Sri Krishna and taught Narada first. So Narada is the second Acharya in the line of spiritual disciplic succession. He is the representative of Brahma, and therefore he is respected exactly like Brahma, the father of all Vidhis, regulations. So that's the significance of Brahma's name. He's called Vidhi because he's the father of all Vidhis, regulations. Similarly, all other successive disciples in the chain are also equally respected as representatives of the original spiritual master. Thus, and the Bhaktivedanta purports of the first canto, fourth chapter of the Srimad Bhagavatam, entitled The Appearance of Sri Narada. So I'll stop here. Any discussion? Bhadra Prabhu. First text.
But in the next verse, Hridaya means puts the heart, in the first he puts the mind, satisfaction of the mind. I don't follow that.
I'm not hearing. Sorry. What did you say again? Can you repeat it?
In the text 26, the word used Hridaya.
Hridaya. I'm seeing. Yes, and the word is there. The word in the word for word, Prabhupada translates Hridayam as mind.
Right.
But so Hridayam is usually translated as heart.
But in next verse, he is putting the heart satisfaction.
Yeah, so heart and mind, internal. Yeah. It's sort of like where, it's not really our heart, right? That organ. We point to our heart, we say, I think this, and we point to our head, and we say, I feel this, and we point to our heart. But it's all going on, actually, wherever the mind is. It's all in the mind. Thinking, feeling, and willing, right? Prabhupada said these are the three functions of the mind. Thinking, feeling, and willing. So the feelings are actually in the mind, not in the heart, not in the organ. But we use the word heart, just like in English, we use it figuratively and literally. My heart is this organ that pumps blood. But you talk about my heart, you mean my emotional self. So the word can be used in different ways. It's one of these words that you look it up in the Sanskrit dictionary, and probably a whole list of meanings for Hridaya. Over here. Sukhada Prabhu.
Thank you for a very informative class. It's really wonderful. I was just thinking, though, that in this Kali Yuga, that everybody isn't living like a king, and it's just getting really worse that way. You know, like when I left Hawaii and I went back to visit, there's like, they have camps now of people living on the beach, you know? Mm. And just everything is declining so quickly. 130 Americans every day are dying from overdose, you know, drug overdose. That's just America.
Yeah.
So the time, they're not living like kings. That's, you know?
Yeah, they should be. Of course, in some ways, because of technology, they do have many things that people didn't have before, certainly. I mean, they're living in the tents and, anyway, I don't know, I haven't lived among them.
It seems like that. Like, I remember, you know, in India, it used to be so peaceful. Then once, you know, when I went to India, I saw the, you know, tent city, like in Bombay. Mm-hmm. So terrible, you know. But people used to be peaceful. They'd have their little altar. But then there were so many antennas, you know, coming up, and I thought, wow, it breeds such dissatisfaction, you know, for people to see, well, other people have this, I don't have that, I'm not happy. Whereas in the past, people could live simply, have their altar, you know, make their offerings, and be peaceful. But the technology has really destroyed that.
Yeah, it's because the mind is not peaceful. Because you can be happy in simple situations. Prabhupada loved that kind of thing. It's interesting because Prabhupada was raised in Calcutta. He was a city boy, he said himself. But he loved living in Mayapur in his, you know, grass hut, chutka walls and so on, and just cooking over fire and so on. And he really liked it. Prabhupada didn't like modern industrial enterprise and so on.
Simple living life in Kenya.
It's very agitating to the mind. It's hard for people to be peaceful. But actually, you know, there are people who, at least theoretically, you could live with practically nothing today. If you, you know, of course, many people are living on the street. They have problems. They have mental problems. There are many, you know, war veterans that are out there in the street. They're because of trauma, and there are many, many alcoholics and drug addicts. Very large percentage of them. So, of course, that's another whole issue. But I mean, that's why, you know, their lives are unhappy. They've made bad choices in their lives often, and they end up in that situation. But Kali Yuga presents, because things are so disorganized and there's so many negative influences there that it's hard to escape it. You become, you know, we're all products of our times. Even we ourselves as devotees, we're trying to wash away all that stuff that's there, you know, that's still haunting us after such a long time. So, yeah, the age, people get moved along with the current of the age, as it said. And it's a current of sewer, you might say. Very people are affected by it in so many ways. Yes?
The topic of mind and heart. Of course, throughout the Shastra, we see the mind and the heart are used interchangeably. In one case, Rishabhdev was speaking to his son, saying, "You were born of my heart." And then we know that the state of consciousness or mind mentality at the time of conception will indicate the progeny. So there is one example of heart and mind being.
Yeah. It just dawned on me recently, just related to this idea of thinking and feeling, or the intellectual, just like our being, you might say. There's really three parts to it, you might say. We have our, first of all, we exist. We are, I am. I'm a conscious self. But what is intrinsic to that are really two things. The intellectual part and the emotional part. That's really what we are, right? So what is that? That's Sat-Chit-Ananda. That's what God is. He exists. He is Sat. And he has his intellectual side, you can say, and his feeling side. So that's really what you might say is reality, or that's being. Being is not just being. I think in philosophy, sometimes the idea is there that God is just being itself. So we would say, well, that's part of it. He's Sat. He exists, yes. He's what exists. But part of him, we say, of course, there's a kind of duality that exists in the oneness of God, that along with that existing, he has these sides. He has the intellectual, the chit side, and he has the ananda side. He has the emotion, and he has the intellect. So yeah, I was thinking of this because a lot of times we have lists of things, and we think, well, why this particular list? I brought this up recently about the three modes of material nature. But the more you think about them, you realize, well, this is it. This encapsulates everything that goes on. Tamas is inertia, and sattvas is peace, and so on. Rajas is action. So these things have to be there. They're part of the mix for the material world to go on. So these things have logic to them. Maybe we don't understand them necessarily. It doesn't necessarily dawn on us unless we think about them. Anyway, so this is, you know, the idea that we have, and God has also, a head and a heart. He thinks, you might say, he thinks to create, but in Goloka Vrindavan, it's mostly the heart side. He turns off the thinking in Goloka. He doesn't think that he's God anymore because he wants to relish with his heart in Goloka Vrindavan. In fact, that's said to be his greatest power, his sweetness that attracts all living, and is greater than his power of creating the universes. That seems like so much power. The universes are infinite. How much power does it take to create? But actually, his greatest power is his sweetness, the attraction, the attractive power of his sweetness, and pleasing in an infinite number of other people, other beings. That's his great power.
I was wondering if you know significance difference between the Mahabharata and Bhagavatam. What I recall little bit that Harikesh Maharaj, I mean Harikesh Prabhuna, he said in 75 Prabhupada gave a beautiful class and he mentioned about pastimes from Mahabharata. So after the class, he asked Prabhupada, should we all read Mahabharata? This was a wonderful story. And Prabhupada said, I never read Mahabharata. I only heard it from my god brothers and people saying this. So I was kind of like, did Prabhupada say we... I mean, he didn't say we should not read. He said he did not read. But do you know any quote like... I mean,
well, the logic of it is, actually, this is brought out in the Tattvasandarbha, that, well, just as we're hearing here, Vyasadeva is still not satisfied, even though he's written the Mahabharata. So he's only satisfied when he writes the Srimad Bhagavatam, because it's more focused on Krishna. That's basically the idea. You get, it's like you go off on so many tangents. I even think like that in the Bhagavatam sometimes. I think, why do I have to hear all this whole story about this or that, you know? It's like now I listened to the Bhagavatam. I'm listening to Dhruva Maharaj fighting the Yakshas. And I think, well, why do I need to... he's pure devotee and this is all part of the Leela and so on. And there are lessons to be learned. But the idea with the Mahabharata is there. It's all these side stories. You have the core story. But then, you know, the Pandavas or someone meets some sage and the sage says, you know, goes off and tells this real long story about this or that. And so it seems to be the idea is the Prabhupada never wanted us to waste the moment. So, I myself feel like I did read the Mahabharata some years ago, but I haven't read it for a long time. I don't think I've ever read the Ramayana. This doesn't attract me as much, I guess, because I feel like, I need to know the philosophy. That's what I really need. I need to understand the philosophy. So I need to read Jiva Goswami, and I need to read the Bhagavatam, and so on. I need to read, you know, Tattvasandarbha and Bhagavatsandarbha, and so on. I guess part of it, maybe because I'm too much head and not enough heart, that's the other part of it. I know there's a lot of heart in the Mahabharata also, very touching stories there, and the Ramayana also, it's a very moving story actually. So that's there. So that's, of course, that's a benefit, obviously, hearing Leela that's related to Krishna. But that seems to be the idea though, it's such a long work and... although, didn't Prabhupada say he was going to translate it? Mahabharata. He often said, I'm going to translate so many things. He began actually translating the Vedanta Sutras. There's some introduction that's available out there. You can maybe find. So Prabhupada had so many plans after he finished the Bhagavatam. He's going to keep on translating and translating.
Mother Janava mentioned that she was at the door one time. Prabhupada had a conversation. He said, I would love to, next book I should translate is Ramayana.
Ramayana.
And Prabhupada said, I love the book. She said she was at the door, she was listening.
Stita D, you had something?
Yeah. It's not very philosophical. But, you know, sometimes we have this thing about Kali Yuga is getting worse, and, you know, I think over time. But gosh golly, in the 30s, they had huge amounts of homeless people. I mean, the few people hanging around downtown was like nothing compared to that. It was like 25% unemployment. They had these things called Hoovervilles, tent cities, you know, people living out of their cars. So, yeah, you know, life's difficult even when it's good.
That's true. The context is
but
important.
It can get a lot more difficult, so, you know, be careful with that one.
Well, I have a hard time even conceiving how it can go for 427,000 more years downhill. I mean, you know, where can it go?
This is nothing. This is like, you know, the cartoons before the feature.
Vegavatifu?
Well, the other day, in my comment to Akuti, I mentioned that I read outside books, but also, when I'm at work, I go to vedabase.com. Right now, I'm reading Prabhupada Lilamrita, but I've been through the whole Ramayana and Mahabharata version that are on the Vedabase. So, just little by little, to save people from outside books, those are available.
Yeah, well, that's a good point, actually. If you especially have a weakness for... I remember Jayadvaita Swami told me one time, he said, my Maya is bookstores. he could go in a bookstore and spend hours in there, you know, because he's an intellectual kind of person who's really attracted to that. So if you have a weakness for non-Krishna conscious literature, read the Ramayana or Mahabharata, but, which is actually a point I often think of too, because sometimes, what am I going to read? I want to read, you know, regularly every day, and oh, I don't know, do I want to read some heavy philosophy right now and fall asleep, or should I read something else, you know, it's going to grab my attention. So read what interests you, what keeps your attention, what inspires you. So if you need that, then, of course there's nothing wrong with it. I'm not saying there's anything wrong with it, but the Bhagavatam, of course, is the crest jewel of the Vedic literature. In fact, Gopi Pranadanthapu, when he's talking about it in the purport, in the Tapasandarbha, in this section, where it's going from the Mahabharata, where Jiva Goswami talks about the Mahabharata, then he goes on to the Bhagavatam. So he mentions there, and he gives some supporting evidence, but I don't remember what he says exactly, but the basic idea is, if there's some conflict between how the Mahabharata describes some incident and what the Bhagavatam says, we accept the Bhagavatam version. Because one thing about the Mahabharata, as a general idea, is that it tends to be slanted towards the Karmakanda side. In fact, you'll hear about there are many versions of it. There's something like even existing like 50-something different versions of the Mahabharata. So the scholars, they make what's called a critical edition, and they analyze all of them and so on. Very scholarly presentation of it. But then the Mahabharata talks about the Pandavas are going back to heaven. That seems to be their goal, is to go to heaven, go to Swargaloka. That kind of thing you'll find in the Mahabharata. Really an emphasis on going to heaven. But of course, the Bhagavatam is not like that. The Bhagavatam is about devotional service to Krishna. That's what permeates the whole thing. That's why it's especially our... And of course, that was Lord Chaitanya. He could have chosen so many different books to preach from, but his book was the Bhagavatam. He was the proponent, champion of the Bhagavatam and Bhagavat philosophy, because it's transcendental. That's the idea. It's Krishna himself. The Bhagavatam is Krishna in book form. That's why we especially focus on it. All right, we'll stop here. Srila Prabhupada ki jai.